I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. All things political coming up this hour. Mark Niket is our guest, national government reporter for Bloomberg News. We'll start, of course, with President Trump's immigration order, temporarily banning entry in the U.S. for migrants from 7 Muslim-majority countries and refugees from around the world. It resulted in large protests in airports and elsewhere all over the country and a great deal of confusion over the reach and implementation of this order. Republican Senator Rob Portman said you have an extreme vetting proposal that didn't get the vetting that it should have. Steve Bannon has now been given a security role usually held for generals. His position has been elevated, and he will be on the national security briefings here. There's a press conference going on right now, so I'm not sure what the status is of this, but news reports this morning said that the president elevated his chief strategist and demoted the director of national intelligence and chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Tomorrow night or before, Donald Trump will announce his Supreme Court pick. We will talk about that and many other issues, of course, in the news. Our phone number for you to join the conversation with Mark, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Mark Niket, national government reporter for Bloomberg News. This is just a sampling of some of the many protests that took place at airports and elsewhere all over the country over the weekend. We'll talk about that at the top of our show, and we thank you very much, Mark, for being with us. Hello.
Hi, Kathleen.
Well, the demonstrations were just very large at airports all over the country. This president has faced the second weekend in his very short tenure as president. He's faced massive demonstrations.
Yes, he did. And in some cases, they were spontaneous, too. The big demonstrations in March we saw last weekend after his inaugural, that was all sort of planned and worked out ahead of time. A lot of what we saw happen yesterday sort of just sprang up with folks who came to protest this executive order that was signed on Friday.
Mm-hmm. And now there has been legal backlash. There have been diplomats in all over the world who have really criticized this executive order. It does appear, and he's received some pushback from Republicans, that they didn't fully understand what the implications were of this order. It certainly doesn't look good to have families in handcuffs being held overnight, to have 70-year-olds who are held in detention, to have people who worked as interpreters for the U.S. Army in Iraq to be held for such long periods of time.
That's right, yeah, particularly, like you say, folks who, like Iraqi translators, have helped us, you know, in the fight in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and, you know, who we would still depend on and continue to depend on, now telling them that they're no longer welcome in our country. And you're also starting to see pushback from the business world as well. Global companies, technology companies like Apple and Google, GE, they're starting to raise objections to this order, too, and concerns that it could affect sort of the ability of their employees to move back and forth from the United States and countries that they do business and affect and heed and hinder their ability to do business. And you're seeing the White House kind of walking back a little bit from, you know, that order. There was some confusion, for example, about whether folks who had green cards would be affected by this and not allowed to travel. And I guess the clarity is that they are allowed to travel, but they still might be subject to additional questions or scrutiny as they're traveling. And I think one of the biggest problems with this order is it seems pretty clear now that this order was issued but not really communicated to the Department of Homeland Security or the border folks who are at the checkpoints, so that it was clear how this was to be implemented. In some cases, you had different airports enforcing or applying the order differently because there wasn't sort of a clear direction as to, okay, here's what the order is and here's how we want you to enforce it.
Do we today know if there are still people being detained and whether or not they've been able to communicate with attorneys?
I don't know what the status is now. I know at least one of the judge's orders required that the White House at least put together a list of anyone who was still being detained. So there was a record and an accounting for that. There were actually three court rulings that sort of weighed in on parts of this order. And one of the things that the president said today and the administration has been saying all weekend is that it's a limited number of folks who are affected. The number they were putting out were only 109 people out of 325,000 who traveled over the weekend were detained as a result of this order.
And tell me, the protests were spontaneous, as you said, and they were very, very large. Why?
Well, I think there's just a fundamental sense that this is not what our values are as Americans, right? We have the Statue of Liberty in the New York Harbor. Give us your poor, your tired, your, I don't have the exact wording, but, you know, we've welcomed immigrants for generations here. We're a country of immigrants, and the idea that, you know, we would just close that off out of fear of terrorism doesn't sit well. And even folks who I think are inclined to agree that perhaps we need to tighten up our security, that our vetting procedures, you know, might stand some improvement or tightening to make sure that, you know, we're not allowing some kind of terrorist threat to come into the country, you know, aren't necessarily happy with the way this was executed and certainly the confusion that has resulted from this order and not implementing it in a way that everybody understood. I mean, the White House is trying to say, well, you know, we can't give advance notice of what we were going to do because that would just allow people to beat the clock and, you know, the bad guys would slip in before the order took effect because they knew that it was coming. But I think there is a sense that, you know, even if our intention was good or that we wanted to do more to upgrade our security or make sure that we were keeping any kind of potential threat out, that it should have been done in a more thoughtful and thorough manner so that it was executed appropriately.
We're going to get response from some White House officials and members of the opposition party during the course of this hour, just little clips that we have found, and I'd like to get our guest's response. And, of course, your responses will be the major conversation, of course, of the hour. Our number is 800-486-8655. Here's what Reince Priebus had to say yesterday.
Well, one of the things in the order apparently is to include green card holders. And that is something that there has been a report that the Department of Homeland Security recommended that it not include green card holders. Why did the White House choose to overrule the Department of Homeland Security on that one?
We didn't overrule the Department of Homeland Security. As far as green card holders moving forward, it doesn't affect them. But here's the deal. If you're coming in and out of one of those seven countries, by the way, identified by the Obama administration as the seven most dangerous countries in the world in regard to harboring terrorists and affirmed by Congress multiple times, then you're going to be subjected temporarily with more questioning until a better program is put in place over the next several months. This is something that 75-80% of Americans out there agree with. We don't want people that are traveling back and forth to one of these seven countries that harbor terrorists to be traveling freely back and forth between the United States and those countries.
You just said something at the beginning of your answer, and it seemed like an aside. This order does not impact any green card holders from these seven countries?
Well, of course it does. If you're traveling back and forth, you're going to be subjected to further screening. I mean, we are going to...
Wait, let me ask you this. You're going to do that. Are you going to do that to American citizens as well that travel in and out of these seven countries?
I would suspect that if you're an American citizen traveling back and forth to Libya, you're likely to be subjected to further questioning when you come into an airport.
Let me ask you this. Why are you confident that's constitutional? And I'll ask it this way, because green card holders, they go through extreme vetting to get the green card, number one. But number two, when they get that green card, they're entitled to all the protections.
What is the story with green card holders now? Has that been made clear?
I think they're still working that out. I mean, you heard Reince Priebus talk about going forward. I think the intent is that, you know, going forward, you know, certainly before the weekend and right after the order was issued, green card holders are eligible to travel even from those countries. And, you know, the worst that would happen is that they might face additional questions and, you know, sort of additional checking to make sure they don't pose a threat. But, you know, clearly there was confusion right after the order on Saturday and even into Sunday as to whether green card holders were allowed to travel, and some, in fact, were detained or told to turn around and go home because, you know, the order prevented them from coming to the United States.
I thought it was interesting that Reince Priebus, and again in comments from administration officials today, mentioned that these countries were identified by President Obama as countries of particular concern.
Right, and I think that part of that is for the justification of why this order was issued as quickly as it was. I mean, clearly what's going on here is, you know, the president wanted to get an order out quickly to keep a campaign promise that he had made to, you know, put in these, he calls it extreme vetting procedures. And I think in terms of doing something quickly, it helped them to be able to rely on the designation of these seven countries by both Congress and the Obama administration as having in need of additional scrutiny. That was sort of a framework that allowed them to issue their executive order. But again, I think the complaints were that the haste in getting this order out was undermined by sort of the chaos that ensued and the confusion about, you know, how it should be enforced.
Do you know, I've read reports that Steve Bannon and Stephen Miller were the ones who were behind all of this. Do you know if that's true?
I haven't done any reporting myself on that. There was a New York Times story this morning that suggested that. You know, it was largely from Steve Bannon and Stephen Miller, who are two close advisors for the president. I don't know if we have definitive word on that, but it's not. It wouldn't be surprising because I think those two individuals in particular are playing, I think it's pretty clear, a clear role in advising the president and helping get these orders ready. I mean, I guess we have to think that they've been working on this during the transition. This isn't something that just came up, you know, once he took office. They've been getting ready to roll these out in quick fashion after he took office. And I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, Steve Bannon and Stephen Miller were in particular involved with these because they are among the closest advisors to Mr. Trump and have been since the campaign.
Mm-hmm. And Mark, do you have any idea today of the number of legal challenges and whether or not there are sufficient grounds to say that this is unconstitutional?
Not yet. I mean, there's three court rulings that we know of where individual challenges were brought on behalf of folks who were detained, with the argument being they were detained illegally. And what we saw in some cases were sort of temporary restraining orders that put the portions of the order on hold pending a full court hearing and review. In other words, you know, the order itself has not been sort of adjudicated as to whether it's legal or constitutional, but judges found that there was sufficient probability that that kind of ruling would come, that they felt the need to stop the pieces of the order from going into effect. So what's going to happen now is the legal process will play out and we'll have full-blown hearings on the various issues that were raised in these cases and ultimately some sort of direct ruling on the order itself.
This is what Senator Schumer had to say yesterday. It was a very emotional press conference for him where he had people who had come here from various parts of the world talk about their experience in America. I will tell you what Donald Trump tweeted about this after we hear from Senator Schumer.
This executive order was mean-spirited and un-American, and I, as your senator from New York, will claw, scrap, and fight with every fiber of my being until these orders are overturned.
The president again took to Twitter and said that Schumer cried fake tears, and I'm going to ask him, who is his acting coach? Mark.
Yes, and the White House has also pushed back strongly against any suggestion that there was chaos or reporting that, you know, shows there was confusion as a result of this order. Again, trying to blame the media for, you know, blowing things out of proportion. And at one point, too, the president tried to sort of blame this on a power outage that Delta had. But unfortunately for him, I think the outage was like 48 hours after his order was issued, and only lasted 3 hours and didn't involve affect international flights.
Mm-hmm. How do you think, and this is sort of impossible to know, but with a number of these demonstrations, and there were certainly a number of supporters who gathered on abortion issues over the weekend, that was also a very large march, but how do you think that the administration will handle what appears to be a series of spontaneous protests, and I'm sure there are more coming? What do they do about that?
That's a good question. We'll have to see how they react, if their stance is to sort of try and ignore it or, you know, minimize its importance or its effect on them. I think one of the things that will be harder for the administration to ignore or to try and suggest is not a big deal is the pushback they're getting from international businesses, big companies, like I said, like Google and Apple and GE, because if the administration is hearing from business executives that this order is interfering with their ability to do business, you know, that's something that's certainly going to get Donald Trump's attention. I think something the administration would have to respond to. And the question at this point, I think, is, you know, what accommodations might still be made that would, you know, alleviate some of the concerns that people have about this order. You know, there's been some talk today, for example, that the Pentagon might be able to take some steps to protect Iraqi translators and military partners from the impact of the order, somehow carve out, accommodations for specific people. We don't want to be affected by this, but it's pretty hard when, you know, it's sort of a blanket order affecting seven countries and even, you know, open question about whether it stops with the seven countries. After the order was issued, you know, a lot of people pointed out that, you know, while these were the seven countries that had previously been identified by the Obama administration in Congress, they certainly did not capture Afghanistan or Pakistan or Saudi Arabia. And these are countries that produced the 9/11 attackers who came to our country for those attacks. And, in some cases, you know, the list did not include majority Muslim countries where Donald Trump has business interests. And the question was, well, why not those countries if we're going to name these seven? And I think the response from the administration was, well, this is a starting point, and we might see other countries added to that list. Again, maybe they pick these seven because it allowed them to get the order out quickly and they'll follow up more. But, you know, if they're also trying to expand the order at the same time, they're limiting, you know, certain aspects of it to protect certain groups of people. You could see where that could become complicated.
Let's spend just a few moments on Steve Bannon, and then we'll go to phone calls, which are coming in, as you might imagine. The president reorganized the National Security Council, elevating his chief strategist, Steve Bannon. NPR describes Steve Bannon as the former head of Breitbart News, a far-right media outlet promoted conspiracy theories and is a platform that is Breitbart News, a platform for the alt-right movement, which espouses white nationalism. What is the relationship between Trump and Bannon, and is there any concern about Steve Bannon? Well, I know there is concern. How widespread is the concern about Bannon's elevation?
Well, Steve Bannon, the former publisher of Breitbart, came on to the campaign I think right around the time that Donald Trump was securing the nomination, and sort of served as a chief strategist for the campaign and is going to fill that role in the White House. This is a role that previously Karl Rove played for former President Bush. David Axelrod played this role for President Bush. This is sort of your chief political guy in the White House who advises you on the political matters or the implications of policy decisions and what kind of impact it would have politically. And I think the concern with elevating Steve Bannon to this position on the National Security Council is that this is an entity that is no way intended to be political. These are military and foreign policy folks who, you know, their job is to give the president sort of the facts and the unvarnished, view about what's happening as they make important national security decisions. And I think the concern was putting somebody whose role is purely political sort of in that world of, not political, or at least, you know, supposed to be based on facts, raises an element that maybe you might not want at the table. The White House is trying to push back today a little bit, saying, well, you know, people are overreacting to this idea that, you know, Steve Bannon is going to be at the table because, you know, David Axelrod walked in and out of National Security Council meetings when he was there. But I think the most of the concern is just the structure of the order, the way it was issued, you know, really does seem to diminish the role of the Director of National Intelligence and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and promote the role of the chief politics guy. And that is certainly, I think a lot of people would say, not what the role of this council is supposed to be.
Mark Niquette is our guest, and it's All Things Political you're listening to. He's national government reporter for Bloomberg News. The president also expected to announce his Supreme Court pick. It's said to be tomorrow night at 8 o'clock, so we'll ask Mark if he has any inside info about who that is likely to be. And we welcome your phone calls. We'll start taking them in just a moment. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 800-486-8655. Email talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter at K Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network. All right, a number, 800-486-8655. We have lines open right now, and we start our calls with Tracy in Wauwatosa. Hi, Tracy.
Hi. You know, I realize there's so many protesters, but I wonder if they really realize what they're protesting against. I think the president made a right decision. I mean, and this is only a temporary ban. Something has to be done sooner or later, and if he waited and a major catastrophe happened, people would be saying, well, he had all this talk about doing something about who's coming in this country. And I think he's acting fast, and he's doing the right thing, and this is only a temporary ban. And I think we've been just letting people in who have no family here, who have no jobs, no prospect for jobs, and we can't just keep supporting everybody coming into this country. And I think President Trump made the right decision.
Tracy, are you worried? It would appear that a number of the people who have been held back were coming here to do medical research at top-notch universities. They were students. There are people in the film industry. There were a lot of people. There were people who were working with American troops in countries overseas. Do you think it's fair to those people to just say there's a hold on all of this? What about, you know, grandmothers who are coming to visit their family and have green cards? It does appear, from what I saw at least on news coverage, that a lot of people were unnecessarily hurt by this, being held in handcuffs at times.
Well, yeah, that does seem extreme, but again, something has to happen, and maybe they'll, you know, let some of these regulations go, but he has to start somewhere. And I mean, I used to be a Democrat, and I realized so many bad things that happened, they could have been prevented. And, you know, these are scary times. What if there was a major bomb that went off at Disney World or Disneyland? Everybody would be saying, why didn't we do something sooner? And sometimes a lot of people will be against a decision, but it's the right decision. And I think we have to do something. We're just letting too many people in. And, you know, I've heard some Republicans saying, hey, we can let people in if they go through the right process, have family here that can help them out. But why should we have to support so many people coming in? But you're right. The other people that have valid reasons for coming in, I'm sure they'll figure out a way to let them in. But right now, he has to do something.
Thanks, Tracy, for your call. Mark?
Well, I think there's sort of a misperception, if that's the right word, that we don't have any kind of screening or vetting process for folks from these countries, in particular from outside the country in general, coming here, or even refugees who come to this country. And for example, if you have a green card, that means by definition you've been through a whole vetting process where you know there's been background checks conducted and sort of steps taken to make sure that, you know, you're okay to come to the country, or that there's no red flags. And the same thing with the refugee vetting process. You know, unlike in Europe, where, you know, it was pretty easy, unfortunately, to have migrants and refugees sort of moving from border to border without any kind of vetting, you know, our process has a pretty established screening procedure that can last 18 months to 24 months, where, again, databases are checked, social media is checked, and, you know, an effort is made to ensure that there isn't a problem with letting this person in the country. And, you know, we can quarrel, I think, about the, you know, the specifics of the procedures we follow, and even, you know, look at whether they're stringent enough, or that more could be done to make sure that they're catching who we want to catch. But I don't think it's right to say that we're just not doing anything. And again, sort of the pushback against the president's order was, You know, it was done so quickly without enough time to gauge its impact or communicate, you know, how it should be enforced. It sort of leaned on the side of, well, you know, we're not doing anything. We have to do something now in case something slipped through the cracks.
Let's go to Elaine in Colfax. Hi, Elaine.
Hi. My husband is a resident alien. He's a citizen of the Netherlands. And we've been married 33 years, and we own a house in rural Wisconsin. And he has paid taxes. He's paid Social Security. He, even when he was a young man, could have gone to the Vietnam War. He had a number. And his brothers did, too. And his parents, when they came over from the Netherlands, they allowed, as the children grew up, to make their own decision about whether to become a United States citizen or not. And he chose to stay Dutch because he worked in England and he worked in the Netherlands. He lived with his grandma for a while. And when he came back, he kept his citizenship because he felt connected to the Netherlands. And the health care benefits are extraordinary. And as a wife of my husband, I too would have extraordinary health benefits if we needed to go to the Netherlands for care. So I just wanted to humanize this idea of the green card carrier. My husband has a small business, and we contribute to the income of the area. These are real people that have real jobs that are contributing to society, that care very much about this country and love it. They just happen to still have an allegiance, primary allegiance to their country of birth.
Thanks, Elaine, for your call. And my understanding, although it's very confusing, and the administration is going to have to lessen the confusion here, is that if Elaine's husband were in the Netherlands right now working on business and was to come back to the United States, that he would be further vetted? Is that where it stands right now, that it wouldn't be an automatic get on the plane and get off in Wisconsin?
I don't think from the Netherlands would be a problem, but if he traveled to Iraq or one of the, you know, seven countries on the executive order list, I think he might have some more challenge getting back into the United States from one of those countries. I think, you know, the order as it stands, you know, pertain to those seven countries and, you know, limiting or preventing travel in some cases from to and from, you know, those areas.
I see.
If you're traveling from outside that area, even if you're a green card holder, I don't think there's necessarily a problem.
But if he were going to Iraq, to Baghdad to do business, he might face troubles.
Right, exactly.
I see. Thanks, Elaine, for the call. Kurt in Chippewa Falls. Hi.
Yes, hi. At this point, a week and a half into this administration, it should be clear by now, and it is a fact, that the Republicans in Congress are the only people that can do anything to stop this madness. Have you detected any willingness or courage among the congressional leadership to get together and mount some sort of resistance to this madman?
Well, I think you have seen individual senators push back against this order, either to, you know, raise concerns about how it was implemented, even if the intention was good, but also senators, Republican senators, who have, you know, raised the specter that the order could do more harm than good. There's some concern that, you know, by singling out these Muslim-majority countries, you know, we could, one, you know, hurt our standing in the Muslim world, or at least, you know, make this a, you know, an opportunity for ISIS to propagandize, you know, the U.S. role and, you know, recruit more members to fight against the U.S., or, you know, just hinder the willingness of some of our partners in these countries to work with us as we continue to try and fight terrorism. So there's sort of that concern there, too. What's unclear, I think, is just how far it goes. I mean, at this point, we've just seen sort of individual representatives speak out, and certainly we've seen Democratic congressmen and senators showing up at airports in protest. But in terms of sort of formal action that Congress might take to try and weigh in on this order, or, you know, even pressure that might be tried to brought to bear on the administration to modify it somehow, it might be a little early to say what's going to happen there. But, you know, I guess we'll see what happens if the protests continue. And again, if the business community in particular continues to express reservations and is able to show how this is hurting them, that also, I think, would sort of maybe get Congress to be a little more out front and active in trying to, again, modify or if nothing else, clarify pieces of this order that are having a negative impact.
And yet, Mark, doesn't the president have pretty wide range authority when it comes to executive actions?
He does, and even as it pertains to the court case, there's some scholars out there who think, you know, the chances of these court cases ultimately striking down this order, for example, you know, aren't that great because of, like you say, the authority that the president has in this arena. But, you know, we could see Congress get involved, and even if it's just, you know, a lot, a numbers game, right, with, you know, a significant number of the particular Republican House members and senators weighing in here. I think that would put pressure on the White House to take some kind of action, if nothing else, to respond to the concerns that are being raised.
Thanks, Kurt, for your call. Dorothea in Madison, hi.
Hi. I am so happy to be able to say that I totally with Tracy, your caller earlier, and I just feel like the safety of the United States is way more important than individual, you know, like one time I was at the airport and I got pulled aside and checked out. Well, you know what? When I thought about it, it was kind of embarrassing. But when I thought about it, I thought this is just for everybody's safety. What if I would have been carrying something or meaning somebody some harm? So I'm totally for Mr. Trump, yes, President Trump putting this into effect.
Well, then, Dorothy, you must think that it didn't go far enough, right? You would like to add other countries that have Muslim majority?
Well, yeah. You know, there's a lot of criticism, but we're not sitting in the White House. We're not privy to all the information that the president gets. So there may be a reason. I have no idea. I mean, a lot of people are probably thinking it's his personal reasons. Maybe it is. I don't know. And I hope that's not the case. But there's things that the president knows that we will never know. You know that, so.
Thanks for the call, Mark.
Yeah, the caller's right. We're not privy to, you know, the kind of intelligence briefings that the president's getting and if there was some kind of threat out there. But again, I think the concern that's being raised about this order is that, you know, it's not like the current situation is such that people are just free to come and go as they please. You know, there is a pretty thorough process for vetting, in particular, refugees coming to this country and, you know, not necessarily from these specific countries in terms of heightened security or screening, but, you know, certainly the processes we have in place, you know, are there to, you know, try and catch folks who, you know, have some kind of red flag in their background as it pertains to, you know, terrorist affiliation in particular. And again, we can quibble over whether that's sufficient enough, but, you know, I think one of the questions at this point is, you know, is the order as it's being executed really going to, you know, do what it's intended in terms of adding additional security and protection for the country, or is that sort of outweighed by the negative consequences we're seeing and even from the confusion of how the order is being implemented?
And I wonder, is he attending his intelligence briefings now? I know he wasn't. He was doing it sporadically. Is he now every day?
Yeah, I don't know for sure. I haven't seen any reporting on that. You're right. There was some reporting during the transition period that he wasn't going to all the briefings or he was going to rely on his advisors to tell him when something was important. You know, now that he's in the White House, I don't know, you know, what's happening there. Traditionally, the president gets a daily briefing in the White House. I don't know if that's happening with President Trump, but that's part of his day now that he's president.
Claire in Madison, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Yeah, Donald Trump is probably going to have Bannon and go to the daily briefings, and then he doesn't have to waste his time sitting listening. I'm being facetious, of course. Kathleen, I heard a couple of callers sticking up for this, and I want to say to those particular people, President Bush was reminded numerous times, or excuse me, warned numerous times before 9/11 and did nothing about it. But here's my problem with Donald Trump. He is thinking in black and white, no pun intended. That's how he won, on a very simple message in black and white. These are all bad guys. We're the good guys. Life is not like that. It's much too nuanced. Every person is different. If you're Hispanic, you're not all bad. If you're Muslim, you're not all bad. This is far too complicated and complex to do with a sweeping order of all these countries.
Mark.
Yeah, that's one of the criticisms that's being raised against this order, that it is sort of, the word that's coming to mind is knee-jerk. That's probably not right. But the idea that this was implemented too quickly, and clearly there was a political motivation here. I mean, the president, Donald Trump, when he was campaigning, made it very clear that he wanted something like this. You know, it's modified over time. I mean, when it was first announced, actually it was during a campaign rally in South Carolina. I just happened to be covering when he first announced that he wanted a complete and total ban of all Muslims. That was where he started with this position. And it's modified since then, where, you know, it was pretty clear that you cannot impose a religious test for admission to the country. So it sort of morphed from that to, well, we're just going to restrict travel from countries that have a history of terrorist activity. And as we saw with this order, it doesn't even encompass that, because clearly there are countries that have, you know, history with terrorism that are not on that list because they started with the seven. We'll see what happens here. I mean, it's one of the points that the folks who support the president will say is that, you know, this is very early yet. He's only been in office a week plus. Give it some time to work out. And, you know, the other thing that is being said on behalf of the president or in his defense is that, you know, he's doing what he said he was going to do. I mean, he made it very clear during the campaign he wanted some kind of, he called it extreme vetting provision enacted, and he set about to execute that. And again, we can quibble about the details about it, but I don't think there should be any surprise that Donald Trump is trying to go down this path.
Right. I had one more question as I was watching this coverage. If indeed he is targeting seven countries and has talked about Christian persecution in those seven countries, and would then allow Christians into the country but not Muslims into the country, wouldn't that be unconstitutional then? Isn't it a religious test?
Yeah, that is one of the questions being raised about this. This is sort of de facto religious test. In other words, when people sort of criticize this as trying to be a ban on Muslims, you know, the White House will push back and say, well, it's not a Muslim ban. We know we're just limiting the travel to these specific countries. But you're right, the president has also talked about, you know, trying to make it easier for Christian refugees to come here, which would augur towards that kind of religious test. And, you know, there was some comments on one of the Fox television programs. I think Rudy Giuliani was interviewed and, you know, said bluntly that at some point, you know, Donald Trump came to him and said, I want to do something like a Muslim ban. How do I do it legally?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a problem. I mean, there's no question you cannot institute anything that looks like and is functioning like a religious test to allow somebody to come into the country.
Mm-hmm. We'll get back to this, I'm sure our callers will, but I wanted to talk about the Supreme Court pick. It's going to be announced tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. We've been hearing about four people who are on the short list. Do you have any more information?
I don't. You're right. There's sort of a the names differ somewhat depending on who's reporting it, but, you know, this all sort of stems from a list of about 20 candidates that Donald Trump put out during the campaign saying, you know, this would be my list of prospective Supreme Court nominees if I were elected. And they were all conservative justices who, you know, in some cases were recommended to him by the Heritage Foundation or other groups that, you know, care about some of these issues. And I think that's been whittled down since then. And there's speculation about who might be the sort of on the final list, but Donald Trump, the president, has said he definitely will be picking somebody from that short list that he's put out there of justices that he thought were qualified to be president or be on the Supreme Court.
Spicer was evidently asked during the press conference today whether Senate Democratic members would carry out some kind of threat over the SCOTUS nominee, and he said the president has a right to have his nominees taken up, and one could say, well, the previous president probably had a right for that to happen as well. Do you expect significant Democratic opposition on this issue, on any other cabinet nominations, and really on anything, or are the Democrats in such disarray that they can't take up effective opposition?
Well, I think the Supreme Court nomination will be your first big test of what kind of strategy the Democrats are going to pursue in that regard. I mean, when it comes to these individual cabinet appointments, you know, there's not really much the Democrats can do to block any kind of appointment. You know, essentially they would need three senators, Republican senators, to vote against any kind of nomination to block it, which doesn't look likely to happen with any of the picks that Donald Trump has made. But in the case of a Supreme Court confirmation, you know, that would take 60 votes, and unless, you know, the Senate pursues what's called the nuclear option, where, you know, they sort of suspend the rules that require the 60 votes and just a majority would be sufficient to get somebody confirmed. And, you know, the Senate leadership has been reluctant to go down that path because that just opens up a Pandora's box in some ways. So it'll be worth watching how the Democrats approach this nomination. If they decide to force, you know, the Republicans to decide whether to abandon the 60-vote requirement to just get a majority vote to get the nominee approved, that will give you some indication that the Democrats have decided, yeah, this is worth fighting for. We're not going to give in on anything when it comes to this nominee, or we're going to stand united in opposition and sort of force the Republicans to go around them. And they would argue the way the Republicans had to go, force them to go around the GOP when President Obama was in office in his first term.
Mark Niket is our guest. He is national government reporter for Bloomberg News. It's All Things Political. Our number is 800-486-8655. And this is the Ideas Network. Dan in Appleton is our next caller. Hello, Dan.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
It really seems to be frustrating with this whole thing, with this immigration situation. If I remember correctly, immigration is at a 40-year low. And also, in the past 5 years, we've only allowed 20,000 Syrians in. And there's something like a 2-year vetting process to even get to the United States from some of these countries. So, I'm probably just kind of repeating what so many people have said. It just doesn't make sense to sign something because we already have laws in place to stop something like this from happening. We haven't had a terrorist attack in this country for I don't know how many years, so something must be working correctly right now to have to pass this, I guess is what I'm saying.
Mark.
Right, and that sort of, you know, supports the criticism of this plan at least being enacted as quickly as it is, you know, that there really wasn't sort of some huge emergency that we had to act Friday to get this ban put in place, because the caller's right, you know, we haven't had attacks from folks from the seven countries on the list. In fact, we've had attacks from folks from countries that aren't on the list. And like we talked about earlier, you know, maybe those will be added later. We don't know. But again, I think the major criticism is that, you know, was there really an existential need to act as quickly as we did, you know, or was there time to sort of really take an in-depth analysis of, you know, what processes were in place, what improvements need to be made, and sort of a more thoughtful process for making those changes and rolling them out.
Thanks, Dan. Mike in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hey, Kathleen.
Hi, Mike.
Usually I call and I'm angry about something. Today I'm actually frightened. Just a day or so ago, Bannon was appointed the head of national security. And that really frightens me in light of the fact of his KKK connections and his rhetoric and so on and so forth. Being in charge of the intelligence community that is now notoriously known for collecting information on every U.S. citizen, foreign citizens, that means every general, every private in the Army, every congressman, woman, every citizen is going to have their files available to Mr. Bannon and Mr. Trump. And in light of what is going on now, they're picking the Muslims out. Will it be the gays next? Will it be the tree huggers next? And how will we go down the list with this this whole performance by these actors that are in Washington now? This is scary to me.
Mark.
Yeah, I mean, there's concern that Steve Bannon is now going to have a permanent spot on the National Security Council, because again, that's I think it's unprecedented. I don't think sort of somebody serving that role as a chief political strategist having a permanent seat at the table. You know, and this is the they call it the Principals Committee of the NSC, and it's the senior level folks who they consider major national security policy issues. And again, the question is, do you want sort of a purely political guy having a seat at that table when your Joint Chiefs of Staff and your Director of National Intelligence don't have a permanent seat, or at least can attend only when, I think the order has language like when their responsibilities require it. Again, the White House is kind of pushing back today, saying, well, that sort of strict interpretation or reaction to this order that, you know, essentially we're elevating Steve Bannon at the expense of, you know, our career intelligence and military folks is just not accurate, that, you know, those folks can still be able to attend the meetings whenever they want. And, you know, the political guys have sat in on these meetings in the past. I think that the question going forward, and I think what people are going to be watching for, is how does this council operate? Because the order does, you know, specifically give a permanent spot to Steve Bannon at this council. And I think people are going to be watching who actually does attend these meetings to the extent we can find out. And, you know, does that, in fact, influence how the policy decisions are made?
We were wondering when President Obama was going to start speaking, and a spokesperson for former President Obama has said just in the last few minutes, President Obama is heartened by the level of engagement taking place in communities around the country. He had said that he would start speaking if he felt it necessary to have people adhere to a responsibility to be guardians of our democracy, not just during Election Day. So this is really the first we've heard from President Obama. What do you make of his comment?
Yeah, I guess I'm not surprised, because you're right. I mean, people were wondering. They could kind of picture, you know, President Obama in Palm Springs or wherever he's vacationing, if he's still there since he left the White House, watching what's unfolding and wondering, if nothing else, what he thinks about the way things were playing out. I think the President Obama made it pretty clear after the election that, you know, he would be involved, that he was not going away. I mean, I think the question was, you know, how actively engaged would he be? How much would he personally speak out and get involved? And that will be interesting to watch, because I think there's an expectation that, you know, once a president leaves office, it's not his job anymore, right? That somebody else was duly elected by the people, that's sort of his and or her in the future, you know, job now, and, you know, your time is come and gone. But, you know, you're still an ex-president. You still know, you know, obviously a whole lot about all of these issues and have your own opinions about what should happen. And in this particular case, you know, I think it was pretty clear that, you know, President Obama had very different ideas than Donald Trump about what should happen. And even as he tried to ensure sort of a smooth transition from one administration to the next, you know, if you listen to his farewell speech, you know, he made it very clear a lot of the dangers he saw ahead. So, you know, it will be interesting to see how actively engaged President Obama himself is going forward, or what will it take for him to personally get involved, you know, beyond just having statements issued on his behalf.
Machi, is it, in Tomahawk?
Machi, yes.
Hi, Machi.
Good afternoon. I'm a permanent legal resident alien. I came here in the mid-60s. It took me 17 months to gain entry into this country, okay? This is the greatest country on earth. That's why people want to come here. As far as what Trump is doing, I wholeheartedly agree with him. What's the difference? If he would have played his hand, if he would have waited before he implemented this order, these people would have snuck in. All you need is one cell in the United States, and you're going to have September 11, 2001 again.
And what do you say, Machi, when people remind Americans that the acts that have taken place here in Boston and San Bernardino were committed by people who were born here?
People are brainwashed every day. That's why you take soldiers when they're 18 and put them in the service. You don't take a guy that's 25, 30 years old and put him in the service. You want a fresh mind that you can basically brainwash them to your way of thinking, and that's what they do. You know, and the person that was in charge of this, obviously, they're not the one that committed that. They take a person who's weak. And
okay. Let's go to, we want to get one more call in at least. Herman in Neillsville. Hi, Herman.
Hi. People who have a green card, if they leave the United States and make the mistake of being absent for longer than a year, then their green card is invalidated. And it happens every day that people are trying to get back in, and of course, they are being rejected. And no doubt this has been happening in the last few days. The green card is good for life unless you leave the United States and absent yourself for longer than just a day to the year.
All right. Thank you, Herman. I guess we'll be learning a lot more about green cards in the days ahead. And I mean, it's kind of strange to be sitting here wondering, having so many questions about a policy that has been announced, but I guess we'll find out what it all means as the days go on here. Mark, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Mark Niket, national government reporter for Bloomberg News, joining us for All Things Political. A lot of this conversation has centered about on the executive order issued by Donald Trump. We're going to be talking about refugees the first hour of our program today. So I ask you to listen to that to find out what many people have gone through to get their green cards to be able to live and work in the United States. So that's coming up tomorrow during this hour. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour and to Colleen Duvall for on-air production here in our studios. And thank you, everybody, for participating.